Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this week, well, first, the one man who, when you tell him to go take a hike, he takes it literally. It's Dan. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Scott. Nice to see you guys again.
Next, we have someone who draws conclusions almost as well as she draws pictures. It's Jamie. Hey, Jamie.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Hey, Scott.
I know. I was going to try to work in face painting in there, and I said, no, let's keep it pictures, you know. Portrait's a specialty like Dale Sunger. No. And finally, we have our southern gent with his northern bent. It's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. Hey, gang.
So, the four of us, we are ostensibly here to talk about the latest episode of Better Call Saul, which was Rock and Hard Place, written and directed by Gordon Smith, who also wrote such great episodes like 5-0, you know, otherwise known as the Mike Backstory one, or Bagman, which is also known as the Mike and Jimmy in the Desert one. Before we do, and I throw it to you guys, I did want to further embellish a point I had brought up in last week's podcast, because I listened back, and as much as I liked our podcast, I felt I didn't fully articulate what I had wanted to say on one point, so just indulge me for a minute here. I'm actually going back to when I was commenting about the cold open, specifically that when it finishes on that shot of the tequila bottle stopper that tumbles into the gutter. Now, I had mentioned that it's kind of like the rosebud of this whole Citizen Kane-esque opening. And I know I referenced Kim, but I don't think I finished saying what I felt it truly represented and why that little shot is such a bad omen for the season. Or at least it's a red herring, bad omen, I guess, or not, I guess remains to be seen. The stopper, in my view, and I think most people's view, is Jimmy and Kim's relationship. You can narrow that down to essentially representing Kim if you want to go look at it that way. We know that it's a memento from not just the first little con that they did together back at the beginning of season two. It's the way that they bonded at that point like never before. It's the first time they were intimate with each other, and I mean in a carnal sense. It became the symbol of their relationship from that point on. That's why Kim goes back to retrieve it when she quits her job at the law firm. We all know that one of the biggest, if not the biggest question, it's one of the biggest questions lingering over this final season is what is going to happen with Kim. Now here, whether they're screwing with us or not, and we know that they can screw with us, you know, the Vince first does that. That is what that bottle stopper lying in the gutter is supposed to be hinting at in a maybe not that subtle a way. So again, we'll see where they go with that. But they're certainly trying to make us think that way. So I just want to get that out there. Whether you guys think that was kind of obvious from the get-go or not, that's fine. I just wanted to mention it before we moved on. I hope you don't mind. And no one minds. So, all right, so fine. Let's climb aboard the Farewell to Michael Mando tour here with an episode that, kind of like my personal order at a ballpark concession stand, extra nacho, but hold the cheese, please. You know, instead of a little salsa, we get a little bolsa instead. I think we can all agree the Jimmy and Kim stuff can wait, because the focus of this episode is most definitely nacho. And man, did Michael Mando top off an already impressive string of episodes dating back to the previous season with an award-caliber tour de force. I'm going to say it's not just about the words, because often there were no words. It's the physicality of his performance, you know. So the way my brain works, I'm gonna chop it up chronologically, like in four sections. That does not mean you guys have to be beholden to that. You can talk about it any which way you want. I'm starting with the first section, which is the tanker scene. Talk about physicality, because it's an episode that started off with such high tension, and with a hiding place that I personally initially thought, not such a great idea. So let's go from there. And at this point, I am going to, because I've talked enough, I want to throw it to you guys. People want to hear what you have to say about this and everything else. So I'm going to randomly pick. Well, Dan, you watched it today. Would you like to go first for a change?
Sure.
You're a physical guy yourself, so I thought it might be a proper.
Yeah, well, I try not to go deep inside the oil, even though I guess what day of the week is this? Thursday? On Sunday, I like was climbing all over oil pumping equipment that was in the middle of nowhere because that is what you do. So I guess I could have like rolled on some like oil splatter on the ground near a drill pump thing.
As I say, you lost me at climbing aboard pumping equipment, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes that's what the ladies want. You got to give them what they want.
When they want to go mudding. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had the same initial impression as you. Just like, yeah, that's a really lousy hiding place. But going inside the oil was, it was a good scheme. It worked, and it'd be really gross because I don't like to get dirty. So no thanks for that. But it definitely, just a very effective tense scene.
It's kind of funny because, kind of like Mike, Nacho is not someone who's all, you know, he's not like he's not the smooth talking type the way like a Jimmy is. But yet he ends up doing something where he has to hide and he becomes the most slick person ever. See, slick what I did. See what I did there, Jamie? Yeah, rescue me, Jamie. Go.
I caught it. Hey, first of all, I would just like to ask, does anybody know whose truck that was that he was driving? Anybody? I don't know. Nachos, though. Ooh, there's my dad joke for the day.
You know, I can't condemn you because I literally, when I was taking a shower an hour or two ago, I was coming up with all these nacho puns in the shower. And it's like, I'm not writing one down, but I know they're going to pop out.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. As I watched the episode the second time around, I thought to myself, I wonder how many nachos jokes I could get away with before Scott just permanently mutes me.
Hey, I open up with extra nacho, no cheese. I'm giving you as much slack as possible.
It's really what gave me the go ahead. Okay, back to the real subject at hand. Just a few things that I would like to say that I noticed in the tanker. One of my first thoughts was, man, this really makes the scene in Handmaid's Tale with the milk tanker like just seem super lame. because this is like 100% more intense and just worse. This is just worse. But the lighting, I really wanted to bring, I know I always do this, but I really wanted to bring that lighting back in because this was like, that whole time he was hiding in the hotel room, it was just so similar to him hiding in this tanker, minus, you know, the fumes and toxic skin reactions. But man, it was scary, like right off the bat, like first five minutes of the episode, and it was scary. We knew there was a really good chance that Nacho wasn't going to make it out of this situation, but they still managed to make this as intense and as frightening as they possibly could.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, by crossing over with X-Files, I thought it really worked well.
But you know, as the oldest dad here, the fact that I haven't made a bad dad joke before other people have.
It only means you haven't gotten the chance to speak.
It's no. I've just avoided it. But I'll say that the things that stood out to me about the tanker, and then I'll add an extra thought that I want to throw to you guys. But it was almost like he was descending like into hell, like he was leaving the light and going to this really dark like place. And you know the way they set it up with him coughing a lot, like you really got the sense of the fumes and how bad it was. But I thought it was interesting, and I didn't think about this till much later, that it's almost like he was anointed or baptized in oil, and like he completely submerges himself and comes out And then, like, that's the moment that, you know, he sort of comes up with the plan to do, like, to make the sacrifice. It's almost like, you know, he's anointed and he gets out of the tanker. And I will say, I mean, you know, we've worried about Nacho, but I'm just curious from talking to you all, and maybe Scott would want to do this later, and if you want to push this question to later, but when you started watching this episode and this happened, did you think this was the episode, like, they were going to kill him?
I thought this would be where his, if his story was going to end with death, I figured it was going to be this episode.
Yeah, well, if anybody that could write an internet article, like, without using the most obvious headlines possible, I cannot tell you that I was surprised. Just saying.
Yeah, I was really worried for you, and I shared an episode on our Facebook page, which you should go check out if you listen to the podcast. And yeah, I tried to find one that didn't spoil it, yeah, because so many spoiled it.
Even the Better Call Saul Facebook page was fucking spoiling it constantly. I mean, it's like, you know, you'd have to be really fucking dumb to not understand what they were saying. But
yeah, it would have happened even faster if you had walked into the Twitterverse.
It's the danger of not watching it the night of. I get you. I mean,
was fucked anyway because he was burned by the Fring organization, and like the Salamancas knew he was the bad guy. So like there was just it wasn't too likely he was going to escape, especially since his fake ID was gone. So, but, you know, it would have been nice to not, whatever. But, you know, it's fine. I mean, it's cool.
I did mention on our Facebook page, it might have been a comment I made on the article that Brian posted. I don't remember what I posted in relation to, that a friend of the podcast and guest a couple times, my friend Kevin, who works at AMC, and he posted something earlier that day, you know, the promotional image for this specific episode, which was a set of keys, I guess for the whole Keymaster part. But he said, his comment was, you're going to want to watch this one live, which made me go, okay, this one people are going to get, spoilers are going to happen right off the bat on. But your situation, obviously, we know you weren't going to be able to. I watched it when I got home at 2 a.m. that night, but I didn't look anywhere. I just went right to the episode. But I just anticipated something was going to happen of that nature. But I can't tell you with any certainty I knew he was going to die in this episode.
I thought he would die in this first half of the season.
Yes.
But I didn't think it would happen like, you know, the third episode in. I was kind of shocked that it was that fast. You know, I knew you guys weren't watching it live, and I sent Jamie a message, and I said, have you watched yet? Because this is one of those things, I wanted to say something. I needed to process it with somebody. And Jamie's answer to me was, holy fuck. That's all she sent back. And I was like, oh, okay, so you've watched.
Yes, you've seen. And I would also like to say that, Dan, I find there's some sort of magical whimsy in the fact that you may have missed it when it aired, and you may have been spoiled, but while it was happening, you two were jumping around oil tankers and apparently walking through fields of the very flower we saw in the opening scene.
Yeah. Yeah,
and posted pictures of it.
Yeah, so if all goes well, that means this is our second podcast of the season, so I should die the next one. So keep listening. It's pretty much
episode three, Dan.
Yes,
you better hang in there, buddy.
One thing I also liked about this scene and the way it was constructed is that he had to stay in the hot oil tanker. I mean, presumably he's in the desert. It's probably hot because he couldn't leave without leaving a fucking oil trail. So that I really like that. I mean, it's just smart and like an extra element. It's like, oh yeah, he's got to stay in there covered and stuff until dark. Really cool.
Actually, had a thought going off. I guess it was something Jamie said when you were remembering Handmaid's Tale. I think it's interesting when a writer has the opportunity to have a scene like this where you're going to submerge a character in who's hiding whatever. There's always going to be that additional symbolism about what it represents. So yes. Like the milk and Handmaid's Tale. Of course it has to be milk. I mean, you could spend another 10 minutes talking about what that represents. Kind of obvious. We've seen movies or TV shows where someone's hiding in something where they're literally hiding in shit. You know, like in a cesspool sewage kind of thing. You know, I'm not even talking about Schindler's List. I'm talking about like other things. The fact that it's oil, I think, also is very interesting because, and especially when you also add in the idea of the fumes and the toxicity. Well, that's a great one when you got a lisp like me. It's because, you know, oil being something which, you know, what it represents. Because of what of the people he's dealing with and the situation he's dealing with, you know, a lot of this is about money, you know, whatever. And oil is about riches, but it's also, you know, it's dirty, you know, and it's dangerous, you know, the toxicity, whatever. And the fact that they came up with all that and that's what they popped him into, I thought, oh, that's very smart. That's very clever. And it's one of those things, you know, if only when you start to think about like, oh, okay, that's interesting. Very nice. Very nice. The only other thing I want to say is that I did take the time when I was watching and I did this at 2:15, 2:20 in the morning when I'm watching and I always, you know, and I see the subtitles on for, off in the distance and with the cousins and they're looking for him. And, you know, I just wanted to make sure my Smash can be rusty at times. So I wanted to look up the words and what they're told by the people, what we hear them talking about. The translation is there's a farmer. Maybe he saw it. So maybe he saw what happened. And that's what gets him to leave. Okay. So let's move to the gas stop.
Before we do, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
This is the last thing I want to ask. Whenever I watch anything, like whenever somebody like submerges and holds their breath, do you hold their breath with them to see if you can hold your breath that long? Yeah. Does anybody else do that besides me?
Yes.
Like I actually did. And like, I think like he was under the oil, like almost a minute. And like I didn't quite make it. And I was really impressed that you know, Michael Mando did that stunt and actually was under the under the liquid, whatever they used to do it with, that long. That's a long time to just hold your breath. So,
and not just hold your breath, but like move so minimally that there's no movement at the surface.
Right, that the surface is completely like placid and no ripples. Yeah, it's impressive.
I don't do that. I'm sorry. Maybe it's because I never
give it a try. Give it a try,
maybe,
Scott.
Maybe it's part Join of the us. Maybe it's part of the never learning how to swim thing. So therefore, I never tried to do anything that involved. Because like no. If I go under something, that means I die. So. So,
well, you should use that as a pickup line.
That's why if I'm sleepy, I never have soup. Just, you know, you never know what might happen. one last thing since we stalled in the tanker here, just to top something, not top, to go on top of something that Jamie mentioned about the lighting. I was very taken with the lighting of that scene. And as a result, the image that we're going to use for the podcast is actually a shot of him in the tanker, looking through the little, the hole
like
in the side.
Sunbeam.
I love the way that shot looked. And when I actually could find the composition of that shot. I tweaked it a little bit, but, I said, oh, that's going to be the shot. Cause I was trying to find like, Nacho had to be the image for the podcast for this week's podcast. I just had to find the right one that didn't like automatically say, "Oh, there he is, about to shoot himself or something." Oops, spoiler if you haven't. Anyway, so let's get to the gas stop. And I think the gas stop deserved its own conversation because I thought that this part of the episode, although we were already aware of it, it's where the soul of Nacho is really revealed, from his interactions with the mechanic to his call to his dad, of course, and then even then his subsequent call to Mike. This, I think, is the part of the episode where the empathy or sympathy or whichever pathy works for you kicks in. And this is also, we get to see another side of the work that Michael Mando is putting in this episode. Again, I'm gonna tell, hey Ray Sehorn, I know you refer to it as a tour de force, but I tweeted that before you did, so I used the phrase before you. That's right. Anyway, so let's talk about the gas stop a little bit and all the stuff that happened there. I really love that part of the episode. Jamie, would you like to start us on this one?
Yes. Just a few notes. One, the gas station tenant manager owner, that's one hell of a guy. And it's one hell of a guy that you could probably guess he doesn't see a lot of business unless there's trouble. It just kind of feels like he knows he's seen people deal with trouble out there in the middle of nowhere, and just brings the rag over to him when he is washing his body. No questions asked, just here you go. So that's one spot that just something I noticed. One thing that I really do love in this, upon reading after watching the episode, is that when Nacho calls his father, okay, when they are actually shooting this scene, he made sure that that when he was talking to Manuel on the other end, he wasn't actually talking to him. So, you know, a lot of times the actors will come in and they'll do the other end of the phone conversation so that phone conversation really feels more authentic, helps the actors out. But he purposely asked the actor to not be there because Nacho has spent his entire life with the cartel trying to keep his father as far away as he possibly can, knowing from knowing how deep he is into the trouble, because one of the biggest burdens that he carried was he did not want his father to feel the guilt and the responsibility for the choices that he had made. So when he decided to do this scene, he did not want to speak to him because he wanted to continue to keep him as far away from the responsibility of his actions and to keep him as safe as possible. And I thought that was really something. Anytime an actor truly feels their character as a real living person with obligation, it always shows in their performance.
It's kind of like a variation on method acting to a certain extent, at least partially.
Yes. Yeah.
Brian, you want to pile on to that?
Yeah, I'll go next. I thought, you know, the thing that stood out to me when I took the notes was just two things that I thought when he first encountered the gas station attendant, like, he's the first other decent person that he's met. And his initial reaction is to go to the gun. And he's on guard because he's in this like place where he has no friends and everyone's an enemy and everybody's out to get him. And that guy disarms him by just handing him the rag and sees and he sees like the humanity in him. And it's, you know, which is a reflection of him and who he's been. And it's, you know, I thought like that moment almost choked me up as much as the phone call, because he just relaxes for the first time this season. Like, it's the first time he sees a decent person. And then he goes on to the phone call, and the phone call, it's one of those great tropes of writing where like the phone call isn't really a conversation that he's having with his dad, and he's talking about something and his dad's talking about something completely different. But in true sacrifice fashion, he doesn't, you know, he keeps his dad ignorant of what's happening, and his dad doesn't realize it's the last phone call he's going to have with him, but he knows it is, which really shows like it's true sacrifice. Like, it's not to ease his mind about, you know, making things right. It's just about hearing him one final time. And it's his way to say goodbye without saying goodbye and be reminded of the goodness and what he's given up and why he's given it up. And I thought it was beautiful. This whole scene, I mean, this is the best part of the episode to me.
Oh, Brian, once again, what was it that the mechanic does to him when he meets him? What was the word you used again?
Humanity.
No. It was a verb you used. What the mechanic does to him when Nacho is in.
Oh, he disarmed him. Like he. Oh.
Okay. You get the badumch, but my nachos doesn't.
I didn't think of that. I forgot I had a rim shot in the fucking thing. I just use it for. You guys usually inspire crickets, not rim shots. I'm sorry. Oh man, Daniel, did you want to weigh in on anything from this sequence? I mean, with a lot that hasn't been said so far, so I figured, you know, lots of room for you if you want to pop in with something here. And if you don't, then that's fine.
Yeah, no, it was just kind of, you know, they covered it pretty well, but it was just one of those kind of cliche scenes, but not like, you know, like a lame way. Just you're seeing a lot of stuff, you know, when somebody's kind of making peace with their whatever, saying their goodbyes. It's, you know, like a kind of thing that would happen like a war movie or whatever, depending on the situation. So, it was good, effective, kind of the only, you know, nice calm scene. And I like the actor that was playing the dude that was helping him out slightly. He definitely had a good demeanor to him.
Well, it's interesting because so much of this area was supposedly Salamanca territory, so you couldn't trust anyone. Now, I don't know if that means that he actually escaped to a sufficient enough distance where this wasn't Salamanca territory. That's not made clear, but I'm going to assume that is the case because I can't imagine this guy wouldn't have been aware of it if he was within that area. Combined with the fact that clearly between the end of this scene and then when we get to the next Nacho section that he's able to be smuggled back. Oh, now you can get him. now you can get him smuggled out of there in a truck, like, you know, like that. You know, all this other time you couldn't. Well, that's right. You want them dead anyway. Just to further articulate my thoughts about it, what I liked about it. And I get what you're saying as far as, I'm too reluctant to use a word like cliche but I know what you mean. You're right. You're not wrong in using it. It's the familiar. Oh, this is where this is going to happen. We've seen, you know, whatever. And obviously it's, but when you get the acting and the writing, then it goes beyond that. So that's, I know it's what you're saying exactly. I loved his performance.
Yeah, it didn't feel tropey or whatever. Just kind of like, you know, if you've watched a lot of stuff, you can kind of see, like, you know, the elements
right.
of it. But
right.
it never felt like, you know, fake or manufactured. It's just like, this is this part of the story.
Right. And I love that we can switch from that. You know, we go from heart to head because there he's dealing with his dad and the emotions that he's really doing. Everything he's doing now is to keep his dad safe. And he's saying goodbye to him without his dad being aware of it. And now he has to switch to his next phone call where he switches from heart to head, where he has to call Mike and gets to have his moment of, hey, kind of screwed with me there, man. But then he gets on the phone with Gus and so on and so forth. There was something else I wanted to say and it just snapped right the fuck out of my head. So maybe I'll remember it in a second.
Well, if I could take this 1 second while you think on that. Just something I found really funny is that when he is talking to his dad in that phone conversation, his dad is like how we always see him. And he's like, okay, well, you know, you got to deal with whatever you got to deal with that. I have work to do. And he's always like, he's always like every time it's like, I got to get back to work. I have a job to do. And then he switches over, has the conversation with Mike. And immediately Mike's like, not my decision. He's got a job to do. And so it was great to see his actual father and his proverbial father really be at the same place. Like, there is a job to do. You have responsibilities and I'm taking control of mine.
Excellent point. And I love that you looped in Mike on that because it actually feeds into a larger view of Nacho and Mike in this episode and in Better Call Saul overall. Because the way we view Mike, especially when we got his backstory in, coincidentally, an episode written by the same guy who wrote this episode back in season one, where we got to really find out about Mike and what happened with his son. And it made us look back on Breaking Bad. And although we already were saying it, it became even more clear. It's like, oh, Jesse kind of was his surrogate son at a certain point in Breaking Bad. We can see the same thing happening over time with his relationship with Nacho and how he's that's what's inspiring him to stand up to Gus, you know, time and time again, because that's how he's kind of viewing Nacho in that way. So it's a great observation. It's kind of like a My Two Dads kind of thing, except, you know, it's, you know, where's Paul Reiser? to go from one color. That probably wasn't what I was trying to think of to say before, but it was a better thought, so I'm glad you said that. So.
Well, and another quick throwback on Mike, too. I know we've brought it up before, but I would just like to one more time, since this is our parting episode with Nacho, is the conversation that Mike had with Jesse Pinkman so many years ago, where he said, I had a guy. You're not the guy. I don't have a guy anymore. And I can only put all of my heart and feels into that Nacho was his guy.
I love that we can fill in that blank and then make an assumption that that would be him. And that's a, you know what? We don't need, you know, we can stop the podcast now. No more. Scott. Very good.
Jamie wins
the podcast. Get out of here. Now you can go talk about white liberal guilt on the next Survivor podcast or something. Anyway. Inside joke for Survivor fans.
I was going to say that I think the interesting thing with Mike and Nacho is that Nacho sort of does what Mike won't do, and that is, like, Nacho says something to Gus and stands up to him. I mean, he offers him a solution that ultimately is his sacrifice. But he's not, like, begging Gus. He's telling Gus, and he's out of caring. And I think in a way, this is one of the, like, crucial decision points of Mike, that, you know, as much as we love Mike, and like you said, Scott, I mean, at the end, he's not, like, really a great guy. This is one that Mike does say his piece, but saying, it's not my call, and what he lets happen as this goes on. Like, I kind of went out of it and thought, you know, this is like Mike has hit his apex and he's now starting to fall back to earth and towards, you know, a path that's not good. And this may carry with him and weigh with him, but he swallows his pride and does things that, you know, he shouldn't have done to Nacho.
Right, and what I might go further. I told you guys it was okay to jump ahead, so now I'm going to be the one to do it just to finish up on a mic idea here. I had mentioned last week, as our listeners might recall, that, you know, Mike becoming more defiant or aggressive with Gus, and I felt I think something's going to happen, which is going to kind of like put Mike further down. You know, it's going to like, here's what happens. You shouldn't do that. I wonder if how this episode event unfolds, if this is what it is. Because Nacho was the guy he cared, that we know that Mike cared about, and he was in the situation and what he had to do and what ends up happening. I wonder if that kind of breaks him out of that, whatever. I'm not sure, but it could be. This could be the moment that I was referring to without realizing I was even, and I won't say I was thinking about Nacho at the time, although in retrospect, who else would it have been? So just putting it out there. Since we're talking about Mike, you know, that's just as well, because now we're moving right to what I call the next section, which is the return. This is all about how Nacho was smuggled in. And I also will say, more kudos to, writer director Gordon Smith, that the, most writers would get so caught up in trying to demonstrate the whole, you know, how do we get the truck out to where he is? How do we get him in there? Whatever. They cut all that out of it. What they get away with it by having the truck arrive and just and removing everything to take him out of it kind of, it's almost the reversal works is, oh, this is how they smuggled him out. So it's a time saver. We don't take the time to think, well, where did they meet him? By the way, we don't stop to think, hey, how does Nacho remember all these phone numbers? Because most people, when they haven't been a cell phone, don't remember their phone numbers. But, you know, whatever. It's 2000, blah, blah, blah. People were more likely to remember phone numbers than they are now. I did think of that. It's like, I believed he would remember his dad's work number. That was like, okay, I believe that. I was a little iffy on remembering Mike's number, but I was like, eh, you know what? Some things you got to let go.
I will say they did plant a nugget in last episode to make that more believable, and that Mike said he'd been calling him nonstop before his phone would have been completely disabled, or
right.
He would have trashed it. Like he That's was calling smart. Mike nonstop, so you know he there's a good chance he would have remembered it.
Yeah. Okay. No. I love the fact there were things that were planted in previous episodes, which come to unexpected fruition in this episode. And, you know, I'm going to get there in like 10 seconds. Just want to just mention, I also love when they do smuggle him and Mike, unbolts that secret compartment that, you know, again, in case you don't know what's going to happen to Nacho, the fact that when he opens up, he looks like he's already, you know, kind of doing the coffin, you know, I'm a dead man kind of lying there kind of thing. The only thing I want to say before I throw it to you guys, because I didn't mention the cold open, although one of you guys already kind of hinted at it with the flower and stuff. I love the realization that I had when he notices the glass in the garbage bin. And it took me a second. It was because I'm watching it that night, you know, that was just before they cut the commercial and that happened. And then I went, wait, and I rewound back and I just watched it again. And like, oh my God, it's the glass. It's the glass that Gus dropped in the earlier episode. Cause it was like that prismatic effect when they're shooting up, you know, up out of the garbage can at Nacho.
Yes.
And that was when I went, there's the, that's gotta be the piece of glass we saw in the cold open. Because that cold open, in my mind, before we got to this, was probably, if it wasn't the most mysterious, enigmatic cold open in the Vinceverse altogether, that's right, I'm going to make that a thing, man. It's one of them. Because there wasn't, even Pink Teddy Bears, you know, whatever, there's still a bit more to grab onto with that. This is just like, I'm just looking at a desert, I'm looking at a flower, and I'm looking at a piece of glass. I'd like to add
that glass is a repeated theme in these first few episodes. We are constantly seeing close-ups of glass, the broken glass on the truck floor, Gus's glass, the same piece that he's using to cut his hands, which I think is a great tie-in when you go back to Breaking Bad, because what's the street name for meth?
You took it from me.
I snatched it. It was in the air. It was right there, and I snatched it right in front of you, Scott.
Hate you. Ow! My God, hurt my hand.
Yes, again. 2 points.
All right, you guys talk. My hurt hand.
No, I think that this season has been completely plotted and planned with care, that almost every episode we see a nugget that has been, you know, brought to fruition by the writers. And this episode, like you said, the glass in the desert, you know, it didn't connect in place, in time, in setting, that by the time the cold open was over, we're like, what the hell? And so I thought it was wonderful the way that the story's told. Almost, it's almost like the glass is a character, and we see its journey in the story. Yeah. And later, you know, we realize like we've already got an idea, but then as things are happening later, we realize, oh yeah, and I thought it's just brilliant writing and great setup.
So wait, Brian. So was it George Glass from the Brady Bunch, or was it Mr. Glass from the M. Night Shyamalan stuff?
Or was it Philip Glass? Same thing they did. It's the same thing they did in Dead Freight too. You know, like a similar kind of open, and then like the episode's intense, and you're like, oh yeah, that happened.
Yeah, there is a. It's interesting how many parallels one can draw between, especially things that happen in this episode and things we recall from Breaking Bad. The Dead Freight comparison is spot on with the same similar type of cold open. Very glad, so excellent that you remembered that. There are things that are going to happen that we're about to get to shortly that are. Weird parallels to things that we saw in certain well-regarded Breaking Bad episodes. And again, none of this is meant to diminish this episode. In fact, I like what they're doing because it's different spins on it. It's not just, oh, I've seen this before. It's a retread. It's almost like a bizarro universe version of it. Yes. And I say that because, yes. Oh my God, the Superman Lois episode this week was freaking amazing. But anyway, it's a cube. It's a fucking cube. Anyway, sorry. So
This is where so many of our openings, you know, where, you know, through Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, where we go, I don't know what that is. What is this? This is weird. Why is there an eyeball floating around? It's always fun. It's always fun to connect the dots at the end when you realize what that connection is. But this one hurts like a lot. Not just because of what the glass was, but to realize how much time had to have gone by in order for the ground to seed and there to be life thriving where there was no, because if you go back and you watch the whole scene, there's everywhere they're standing, there's no life. There's no life there. It's dirt. It's dust. There's nothing growing. So when you really stop and think, it has to be a couple years into the future. And for some reason, it's cathartic, but it's painful.
That I never thought of it that way. That's a good, wow. Yeah, because the flower, yeah, wow. I hadn't thought of that. That's very interesting. Wow. Well done. Wow, Jamie's on a fucking roll tonight. What the hell's going on here? Anyway, she doesn't even have to agree with you anymore. Yeah, Brian.
I agree with whatever Jamie says. There we
go. Yes. Oh my God. It's freaky.
Yes.
It's freaky.
I hope you waited years.
It's after midnight and it's Freaky Friday.
That is the affirmation I needed.
I actually disagree. I disagree with Jamie because the desert does that every spring for a little while, so it doesn't last long. But it, you know, it could have only been a few months, maybe
y'all
even
can't
2 or 3.
See my horrible face, but I'm making one.
No, I can. Oh yeah. Well, I can agree with that. It is a horrible face.
Practice it all the time.
So back to that section. There are just like little odd things that just I kind of appreciated. I like when they have Gus. Gus drives himself there, I noticed, which I thought, oh, okay. He can drive himself. I like that because they show that in the long shot. But I love this. There's an urgency to Gus that we haven't normally seen. Like, you know, he doesn't do his usual slow Gus walk into the trailer. He's walking quickly. He's walking fast.
Yeah.
He's immediately just holding the lamp to take a look at him because he had said before that, we heard that, through Victor that he looks too pretty. You know, I kind of want to hear, you know, it's like, wait, are those the words Gus used? Cause I want to hear Esposito deliver that line, you know, but no.
Also, was his last meal like carne asada? Like, was that his last meal? I mean, I can't disagree. It's a pretty good choice, but
I just like the idea that maybe he was farting up the truck when he was driving out there. kill me, will you? I kill you. You kill me.
I will show you.
Yeah. I can't believe
I do like that they give him the dignity of a last meal. And that,
yes,
you know, like he actually gets to sit down and eat and he's not having to just like scarf down a sandwich or whatever. And he gets a, you know, a glass of bourbon and or a glass of whiskey or whatever and gets a meal. And it's, you know, it's that thing of being back in touch with what it means to be human, you know, for a final time. And I love that. It was like he was, you know, a death row inmate getting ready to be executed. Yep. And he gets a good meal. He gets a drink. Now, of course, you know, he gets the shit beat out of him, too. But you know, there is some humanity.
Yeah, but his dad beat him. His surrogate dad beat him, so it's okay. You know.
Well, yeah.
Well, and I find that it is interesting that he is in the rock and the hard place that he is in because of his actions and the choices that he has made and the enemies that he has created. But the fact that he's got to take care of things. If he wants his dad to be safe, he has to make this choice. But there's almost like this thing where Fring respects the fact that he's going to step up. He's going to handle this situation. He's willing to make the sacrifice. Because he is treated well. It's not that Fring doesn't have something to gain out of this, obviously, but like, We've seen something with Gus is that there's this strange gentlemanness about his demeanor, but he gets the drink, and a lot of that is Mike too. Don't get me wrong, but he gets the drink, he gets the meal, the plan's laid out. He has the option to do his own thing. It's just gonna not work out the way he wants it to if he does. But there's just something there's probably a better word than finesse, but there's some type of finesse that's being used as we go into the scene.
We're getting there, right?
The end scene.
I think it's about dignity and it's about honor. And I don't want, as much as I love the Gus Fring character and what Esposito has done with it in both shows, I am not going to give Gus credit here. Because
it's Mike.
Mike. Gus has already proven himself to he likes to be perceived as a person of honor.
Yes.
But he's not.
But it's Mike. And
yeah, it is Mike.
This is a great episode too, where you say, you know, Mike says, this isn't gonna end the way that you think it's gonna end. So maybe, you know, seeing Mike step in, and again, this is another point where you realize like Gus really does listen to what Mike has to say, because he's allowing Mike all of this friendly caretaking of somebody who really screwed him over.
Let me say
that
I disagree with Jamie.
Brian.
Fuck Gus Fring.
I also disagree with Jamie.
Gus Fring.
I'd like to interrupt Brian to point out that it's April 29th right now, the day Ozark came back. So go ahead, Brian.
I think that I actually sent Jamie a message. I don't know that anything I saw in Breaking Bad made me hate Gus Fring more than this episode.
Yes.
By the time this is over, he was a coward who used this kid and even had to beat him so he would look worse. I think the only dignity he got was from Mike, and Mike felt bad about what was happening, and Mike made it happen. Gus, I don't think, trusted him until the bitter end. He was like a cat on a hot tin roof at that meeting. I think Gus Fring has no honor. I think he is garbage. And by the end of this episode, I hated him more than any episode of Breaking Bad.
Brian, why you gotta go make good points?
Well, I take this a different way. I think, I don't really think that Gus is doing anything particularly noble here. I just think that he's lost control of pretty much the entire situation for the last several episodes with everything to do with Lalo in this, and he's shown evidence of that. And so pretty much anything that he can do here is an attempt to like reassert control, which he continues to lose over and over and over again. And Nacho seems to enjoy taking from him. So, well, I don't think he really gives a crap about like anything. I don't even really think he cares about making Mike think that he cares about anything right now. I think he's just trying to do whatever he can to like have some kind of control over the situation, because he isn't.
He just wants to keep his dad safe. That's at this point he's already made his decisions. He knows where this is going to go. All he gives a real crap about is making sure dad's okay.
Yeah,
Gus is scrambling this episode.
No, you all make really You make really, really good points, but I will use that to lean against what I said about Mike, and that this is where Mike comes into. He has more control over the situation than Gus does.
Yeah, but he's acting on his own, though. Like, the things Mike are doing kind of, like, exist in a bubble that are separate from, like, what Gus is doing. I'm, like, taking him in a different, a few different...
But here's the thing. At the end of the day, the person who ends up taking control is Nacho.
Yes.
Neither Mike nor Gus. Exactly. The interesting thing, and now we can kind of get into the end, which is Nacho being driven, then dragged out into the desert, and so on. Although just beforehand, Mike does make the case that he wants to be there, although he'll be, at a sniper's perch, how far away he is. The interesting thing about Mike being there, not just to make sure nothing goes awry as far as the plan, as far as he knows, as far as I can tell, unless I'm missing something, Mike is Mike equipped with any sort of listening device so he actually can hear what's going on? Because that was not the impression I had.
No, not that we've
seen. So Mike never got to hear what happened. He doesn't, whatever. Unless he's got like the most amazing lip reading ability through a sniper scope, and I'm gonna assume he doesn't. But he didn't have a chance to tell someone to call him on the phone and leave it open like with Jimmy in the Lalo episode.
Yes.
So in a weird way, it's almost. It's really a shame that Mike didn't get to hear what Nacho mm-hmm. did, because what Nacho does is just it's so goddamn impressive. I mean, that's a hero's exit if I've ever seen one. But we need to talk about this, and then we can also, and obviously this is where you can start to fold in like the parallels to certain things that we saw in Breaking Bad, and they're there for a reason, and you can be, obviously, there's a lot of links between this and Ozymandias and things that were said and were done there. There are interesting parallels and the things, but handled in a different way. So it's not like they're not repeating themselves,
Right.
I'll just take one and then I'll throw the rest to you guys to talk about. When he reveals to Hector that he's the one who put him in the chair, and I've spoken to a few other people who've seen the episode. That got big cheers from a lot of people watching, apparently. My friend in LA, and I have an anecdote about him, which I'll get to a little bit after this, was watching with his wife, and he apparently jumped up and went, yeah, whatever. And he's a 40-something year old dad. It was interesting when you look at that as kind of like, again, I use that bizarro universe parallel to like Walt revealing to Jesse that he saw Jane die and didn't do anything about it. It's the complete opposite effect. One is a gut wrenching, oh Jesus Christ. And the other one is like, yeah, make that cripple squirm, And again, there are other things that we can get into. There's the Hank stuff and so on. But I want to let you guys talk about it. So, Brian, you seem like you're really poised to talk now. So I want to
go first because I wrote this down because I wanted to say it. We talk about Breaking Bad's allowed like X number of fucks. Used to be. They let Nacho use one of the fucks this season.
Yes, they did.
And the quote that I wrote down that I went back and rewound that I loved is when he said, "So when you're sitting in your shitty nursing home and you're sucking down on your Jell-O night after night for the rest of your life, you think of me, you twisted fuck." And when he said that, like just saying it now, I have chills. It was his moment. He was going to go out on his terms, and he was getting the last word. With all these people, he's had to suck up his pride, his integrity, and he told them all what he really thought of them and then went out on his own terms. And, when it happened, I was stunned and I was sad. But what he said before he pulled the trigger softened that blow considerably. Because they don't get the last word. He got the last word.
Right. And considering when we entered the scene, you've got Hector, and I thought this was so freaking brilliant, where we have this close-up of Hector's finger over that bell like it's a trigger, like an old spaghetti western trigger, high noon, we're going to have the show. And oh my God, it was so great. And then, you know, all of a sudden, here comes Nacho with his, like, Kim and Saul, like, finger point gunshots, like, you twisted fuck. Like, he shot him down. Like, he got the final shot in. Yeah, unfortunately, it also made me jump off the couch and be like, no! But I approve of the message.
Jamie approved this message.
I approve this message.
Well, it's funny you brought in the spaghetti western style analogy, which has been, again, that's something that's been going on throughout the Vinceverse. You know, yes. we're always showdowns in the desert and standoffs and things like that. That's just what it's the show. And hey, it's probably one of the reasons I love the show, because I love westerns, and Breaking Bad is, and then Better Call Saul to a lesser extent until now, has always very much been a western. But going with what you were saying, when they're cross-cutting, or not cross-cutting, just cutting back and forth between Nacho and his look, and then we keep seeing Gus's expression and his eyes, whatever, you know, yeah, that's there's a little bit of Sergio Leone going on there. Very minor. They didn't go over the top with it. They didn't go any extreme eye close-ups or whatever.
But, yes.
But I love the tension that's brought out in the scene when he's taking long to even speak. And if you want, and when you rewatch it, you realize when you see his hand, the blood dripping from his hands, it's because he's not just taking the time to what he's going to say. He's cutting through the zip tie right now. So he's trying to cut through it as much as possible before he goes into his thing. I love him just looking over at like Gus and watching their reactions when they realize he's not following the script. He's not doing what we spoke about. And that's when in that realization, we realize he's going out on his own terms. He's gonna have the last say. He's not, you know what? He's not gonna get cut off in mid sentence the way Hank did. I mean, you know, Hank did get to say, ASAC Hank Schrader, you can go fuck yourself. What he said, that's what he says to Hector, is kind of his version of that, I thought, calling him a twisted.
Well,
sock.
I mean, what did Mike say? This isn't going to end the way that you think it's going to end.
But what's lovely and tragic at the same time, it's also not going to end the way Mike thought it was going to end.
Yes, and his reaction, I don't know about you guys, but his reaction when he pulled his eye away from the gun and just looked at the ground and just sat there in silence for, I mean, it, I went back and rewatched it, and it's like 20 seconds where he just stares at the dirt in front of him. It was maybe one of the most emotional scenes I had ever seen him do throughout either series.
Yeah. I agree, but I don't feel that sorry for him. Like, I mean, this episode really took a turn for me.
Yeah.
That I think, like, how I view Mike is now forever clouded. How I view Gus is I hate him more than ever. And what Nacho exposed the weakness in all these people.
Yes. And fun note, everybody in this scene ends up dying. Like, there's no one left alive, is there? Like, not a single one of them.
Yeah, you're right. Oh, look at you.
Yeah, definitely a tense scene, though, even though we know that all these characters were going to survive it except Nacho. I mean, well, he was the only one that did anything. So the show is really good at doing that, making it tense.
And to kind of add to the turning point of Mike, the emotional turning point that you have with him, part of that staring down, see, this is what always just amazes me with actors who are physical actors, is because when he's looking down at that dirt, you can say, okay, yeah, he has a moment of mourning, a moment of shock. But there's also this like thing where it's like, okay, this is where I am now. Like this like path is, oh, like, yep. Okay. Like this is the path. This is who I am now. It's not just grief for losing somebody that he kind of liked and had a little bit of a companionship with. It's like there was a moment that I could feel where he's like, okay, this is who I am now. And there was a little bit of grief, but acceptance in it.
It's seeing somebody that if they do something you respect and they do it with honor, and this is how they still end up, this is the man you're working for. And I thought the thing he conveyed really well on the walk back to the van is like weariness. Like just the sort of like, like his armor was penetrated and he was just weary. Like
getting the continuous gunshot in the background, because Hector seeing him kill himself was nowhere near enough. He has to continue to like riddle his corpse with bullets because he's so angry.
I love that they made a very interesting directing decision with how they handled that, where it's in the background, and when Hector actually is shooting him, it's also being shot through the window of the car door, so it's very hazy. It's in the background. You can't really see it very clearly. There is that brief moment where you see the foot twitch just from the vibration of the shot, but other than that, it's two different things that are happening at the same time. There's a certain dignity we're giving Nacho by not, you know, showing it fully. But at the same time, it's also how this is now just, he's no longer a person. You know, he might as well just be cans in the desert or something like that.
Yes. And if you go back to that cold opener, I know we mentioned the glass. Did we mention that you can see the zip tie? Like that zip tie is in there too. And I didn't see it the first time because it's a black zip tie. So it just sort of looks like brambles or whatever, but that zip tie is sitting right there too. So that's just one added note on that. And also a question for you guys. I feel like when I saw Gus walk to his car and right before he got in, I feel like I saw him like stop and take a really deep breath. I feel like he's like, he almost was like you saw him for a minute go, okay, it's going to be okay. Like this got figured out.
Yeah. He composed himself. Like it worked out. And I do think it's interesting. And I'm going probably two levels too deep here, but you know, plastic zip ties are made of oil and glass is made of sand. And
look at you.
Those are the two items that endure. And just like Ozymandias, where everything disappears, the only thing left is, you know, is the zip tie and the glass.
Oh, it hurts all over again, Brian.
As Brian was talking, I had like a Breaking Bad opening where like all the chemical elements were kind of popping on the screen.
Yep.
You know, oh, glass is sand and diamond is a coal. But anyway.
And just one more thing.
No, go ahead.
With Mando, when they were filming this, they let him do this scene over and over and over again. And they were like, here's the main points, just go for it. So what we saw was like his real calculated rage. That's part of why it felt so, it felt so like cathartic. Again, I use that word, but it's because like he really, every time, every take that they had, he was like, okay, what has he gone through? What has he gone through? What did it lead? Where could he have changed his mind? How angry is he that he chose the wrong path when he knew the right path? How angry are you at these other people for pushing you to those paths? Like every single take, and just a little bit with direction, is like, okay, we've covered that. Let's cover this angle. And so what they really did is they took all these different shots and they pieced together like what Nacho's true meaning and message was to these men that like caged him. And something that's so interesting about him is that he is character is the type of guy that you could have seen being like, obviously he was really close to his dad. You could have seen him being a family man. All these things that like, for instance, Walt was trying to be at the beginning of his life before his selfishness took over. Nacho didn't really have that selfishness. It was just a trip up after trip up that kind of got him into the position he was in. But at the core, he was the family man. He was breaking good. Where everyone else keeps breaking bad, he just kept trying to break good. And all of these bad guys were just pushing him against the ability to do that. So he had his moment, and the actor took his time to really like piece all of this together. And it was an incredibly hard scene to film because things kept going wrong. It, like the area that they were filming kept flooding. Every time they'd go in, it would keep flooding. Like there was a big lightning storm and like the tree in front of his property. Like there was all these omens that it was, there's a long list. You can go in and find it, but it was just one thing after another for weeks. So when he finally got to film it, like he was feeling the wrath of the gods. And I think it really showed in his performance.
Best death on the show. Best death in the Gilligan verse. So far,
I think it could have been better if he had also confessed to Hector about stealing Price's baseball cards. But other than that, it was good.
Okay. I might say best death on the show. I'd have to stop and think for a bit. If you're wrapping Breaking Bad into it as well, but we'll get to that a little later.
I mean, for the character, not for the viewer.
Oh, okay.
Yes, right.
I mean, you know, there's a player in this scene that has a pretty memorable death, you know, a couple of them.
Well, technically they all do if you really think about it. Three of them for the price of one, if I recall.
Yeah.
But I know what you're talking about. But as far as the pre-planned death and how you go and going out, quote unquote, on your own terms, I mean, there's that Walter White might have a case to make here as well, since he obviously goes into the end of Breaking Bad knowing he's not going to be surviving that night. And you know, his last words to Lydian are so awesome. I'm looking at the clock. Throw in the anecdote I wanted to mention, then a couple of trivia things about the Nacho stuff before we then can get to the Jimmy and Kim stuff before we wrap up. Minor anecdote really quick. So I've mentioned before, I have this friend. He's also the guy who's a fledgling newbie producer. He's working on something with me for years, and hopefully it will come to fruition sooner than later. But somehow, ever since he moved to L.A., he seems to have a knack of running into and talking with people in the biz. I'd say he's about thigh deep in the business at this point now. He used to drive me crazy that he was going to the gym next to Timothy Oliphant all the fucking time. And I kept saying, you know what, something wrong with my script, man. He'd met Michael Mando a number of times years ago. He had met him like before Better Call Saul and then ran into him again afterwards. And he had complimented him. It was like, oh, you know, and Mando was really excited that he had gotten the gig, whatever. And one of the first things my friend had said to him was, since we already know you're not a character on Breaking Bad, are you worried they're going to kill you off? It's like, I'm expecting it all the time. I just wait every time. So every time they would run into each other from that point on, like either be in a store or a bar or whatever, my friend would basically do kind of I know this is an audio podcast, it's more of a visual thing, but he'd basically just run his hand across his forehead, kind of do a shoo, kind of a thing every time he'd see him, because he made it through another season, made it through another episode. He hasn't seen him in the last couple of years, you know, with the pandemic and everything else. But I like to imagine if he had run into him again, it's like, hey man, you lasted longer than you ever expected to, and you went out better than pretty much anyone else could have imagined. So I just wanted to get that out there. There are three little bits of trivia that are really connected to this that I found online. And by online, I mean IMDb. It's not like I came up with it myself, but I thought they were kind of noteworthy. I did embellish on one or two of them here. First off, Nacho's first appearance on the series, which was the second episode, Mijo. When we first meet him, he's standing in front of Jimmy, who's kneeling in the desert. His hands behind him. His life is in peril from a Salamanca. Tuco. How does Nacho end? Kneeling in the desert. His hands behind him. His life in peril in front of him. The Salamanca. So I thought, was that calculated? I'm going to say maybe. This episode, it's one of only two that did not have the usual regular outro music as the show ended. The other one was the episode Lantern. Now, Lantern is actually the episode where Chuck dies. So we know that in Better Call Saul, if someone dies at the end, they're not going to play music at the end. But here's the one that I can't believe. 13 years ago, April 26, 2009, Ignacio, the name, is mentioned for the first time on Breaking Bad. 13 years later, the exact same date, April 26, 2022, he dies. That's really weird, but I love that that happened.
Right? That's great.
Now, I don't know. Now, if anything else occurs to you guys about the Nacho stuff, feel free to bring it up whenever. But for now, I think we need to bounce over to what was essentially the B plot of this episode, despite it being about our main character. And one might even say that's been the case for this season so far. I've heard from some people who are watching who are big fans, and it's not that they don't like the Jimmy and Kim stuff. They certainly do. But it's almost like, Yeah. Okay, just get on with it, or get us back to the Nacho stuff, because maybe it's because of the life or death stakes, or what have you, or maybe it's because we don't hate Howard, so it's kind of like, really, why are you gonna do Howard dirty? Like,
you bunch of meanies.
So we do have Jimmy and Kim cooking up the next part of I guess the word we're looking for is audacious plan. But before we get to the whole valet scam, Kim has that unexpected meeting with the ADA, Suzanne Erickson. I had to look up her name. We've seen that she's had a number of run-ins with Jimmy over the course of this, or should I say Saul? Excuse me, Kim. You know, oops. whatever. So I just thought when she starts presenting the situation and they're talking about Eduardo, I was fascinated to watch how Rhea Seehorn chose to play the scene. Which is kind of what we'd expect at this point. She's not going to reveal her cards. She's like a really good poker player. But I'm just wondering, when you're watching that scene and what later happens between her conversation that she has with Jimmy, did you think that was where she was leaning and how she was going to go about it, both in that scene and what she actually says to Jimmy, and the true magnitude of what she says to Jimmy is kind of significant, I think. So I know that happens before and after the valet thing, but I figure that's kind of the fun part. Let's take care of this part first. So if any of you want to jump in on this, feel free. Whoever wants to go first.
I'm pointing at Brian on this one.
Okay. Since you already won the podcast, I will obey. I was not thinking she would go the way she did. Because actually, kudos to the performer who played the DA. Like, once they got in her room and closed the door, she completely sort of changed her demeanor to somebody that sort of was like trying to give Kim a heads up in you know, a collegial way. And like you say, Kim just stayed silent, took the information in, and then turned on her. And made the classic mistake many characters do, is that. And maybe it won't be a mistake in the long run. I think we suspect it will be, but doesn't respond to the facts she says, but responds emotionally to the past slights of Jimmy and the way that this woman has treated him. And although she's giving her all the respect in the world, Kim, she's not showing respect for Jimmy. And we see, like, basically now that, you know, Kim is ride or die for Jimmy. Mm-hmm. And you know, Kim usually deals with the facts presented to her. But in this case, she doesn't. She just sort of tells her to buzz off. Now, she does calculatedly file them away and does sort of broach the subject with Jimmy later, which means, like, the woman did make a point to her. But it's not something she's going to make a decision on without talking to Jimmy and seeing how Jimmy feels about it. And I think that the implication is that if whatever Jimmy decides, that you know, she's not going to leave him or abandon him, that she's there.
I think that what we got to see was exactly the things that Chuck said to Jimmy would happen. I don't think Chuck ever imagined in his wildest dreams that Jimmy and especially not Kim would be, you know, confronting a cartel member in the fashion that she had, due to the influence that Jimmy's had on her. But this is a great example, I think, of what Chuck was concerned about. And we've talked about this with Walt many times, whereas one of his biggest faults was not recognizing when he wasn't the smartest person in the room. And I think we're not really debating on intelligence here, but we are showing that there is a lack of concern and intelligence in the fact that Kim is sort of mosquitoing this. And handles it in the way that she does. There's just a bit of arrogance that there should be more concern and less arrogance in this situation, I feel. And it, to me, it's just like I can feel like Chuck's eyes like burning into this situation. Like, I told you this was going to happen.
Did any of you guys think there was a chance that Kim wouldn't tell Jimmy about this?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't think she was going to.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I thought that as well. But then I realized I forgot what I was watching for the last few episodes, which I think were kind of, I shouldn't say it that way, but I'm going to say it that way. We're giving Kim a little, I'm not saying we're giving her a free pass here, but I think you kind of are a little bit, and you shouldn't be, because what she does when she talks to Jimmy, it's as manipulative as anything we've seen anyone do on either of these series. Think how she phrases it. Do you want to be a friend of the cartel, or do you want to be a rat?
Be a rat.
She's she's putting him in, like, well, of course you're going to pick the former, not the latter. She's already made up her mind what she wants him to do. And again, season one, Kim doesn't phrase it that way and isn't thinking that way. She's gone further than he is right now, because he would have been considering it. She doesn't seem to be wanting to consider it.
And kudos to her on a very basic marriage level, is that anybody who is in a relationship with anybody who is incredibly stubborn and strong-willed and intelligent, like, you really have to throw things out often that make it look like it's their own idea. It's their own idea to step forward in the way that they want to go, you know, that they want to go.
Well, that's manipulation 101. Mm-hmm. Look, I got a little confused. They already have been led to believe before all this that Lalo is dead to begin with. They already were told that. The thing that the bothersome thing about this for me and with Kim, and I'm not going to get into the whole, well, we are going to get into all the other stuff, but it's the unspoken issue that isn't said here. Because even if they believe Lalo is dead, which they're wrong about, but whatever, if Jimmy turns on him in the way that the ADA had described and so on, how does it not occur to them that there won't be other members of that same cartel or that same family or whatever that are going to come after him because of that? Of course they would. He would be in just as much danger. I was almost shocked that that was not broached or touched on at all. And it made me think Kim has her focus has become so much about, okay, we're just going to go after Howard so we can get this money, whatever. And it's starting to be like, I don't know if that's where your focus should be. And I think you really need to think about the ramifications of all this and really, you know, again, it's funny because what she's basically convincing him to do does avoid that issue, but that's not her reasoning. I don't know. I enjoyed it tremendously. It's one of those things. I just feel you can't ignore such an obvious possibility, but maybe by just saying a rat, that also defines as Which means you will be targeted immediately after that.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And I, not to really throw negativity at Kim, because we all love the character and we have up until now, but like she literally defines her like priorities based off of the way she organized Post-it notes. And so like that's how she organizes and maps out her plans and her future steps. And now we're seeing like Jimmy take part in that Post-it note, like, you know, like picture board that they have on the back of that painting, which, by the way, I think is great that they have this on the back of a painting so they can hang it up. No one can see it. But it's like, you know how sometimes, you know, you say things like too many cooks in the kitchen. And this is one of those things, except for one of these cooks is really good at what he kind of does, his shtick. And the other one is sort of new into leaning into the shtick. And it's kind of creating some quiet chaos.
I wouldn't say that she has a shtick.
No, I would say he does. She doesn't.
He does. What she's really good at is strategic thinking.
Yes.
And we've seen it through the whole show that she problem solves and thinks ahead and is a strategic planner. And because he has been weakened by his PTSD, she's stepped in and we've seen a role reversal and she's steering the ship. And like Scott said earlier, I think like there was only one answer she expected to come out of that interchange, and she has a plan. Now, the problem is she's not as deep in that world as he has been, and he's only, you know, dipped a toe, but he's dipped it in enough to know the danger.
Exactly.
And he was the one shot at and almost killed, and she doesn't grasp the full consequence of that. And I think that's where we're headed for problems.
Right. Well, and I think a great like non-spoken indication is they're smoking. Every single scene we've seen them smoking up until this season, they're outside, they're sharing a cigarette, and now they're smoking their own cigarettes and they're smoking indoors. Mm-hmm. And anybody who has tried to control any vice, but we'll use smoking in this for obvious reasons, when you say, okay, I'm only going to smoke outside, I'm not going to smoke inside, or I'm not going to partake in this vice in certain circumstances, I'm going to make it more difficult for myself in order to keep control of that vice. We are watching them make excuses for each other. And this is the codependency thing that we talked about years ago, you know, second season, where you started to see this codependent relationship happen. This is coming into fruition now. So now they're both smoking indoors and they're making these tiny little excuses that by themselves are permissible. They're completely fine until you line them up with every other little slip that they are performing. And this slope is getting really, really steep, and it's getting really scary, and it's getting really scary for Kim.
Right. Absolutely. I don't think there's any problem throwing negativity at Kim. I can love the actress. I can love the character. And I could also talk about how she's going down a bad road, and I'm not even, or a bad choice road for that matter. And I'm not even talking about the cartel stuff. This entire plan that she has pretty much concocted and has Jimmy going along with, number one, at the end of the day, is this plan necessary? No, it's not.
No,
they don't. So that's the first thing where you can lose someone is like, you don't need to do this. This isn't necessary. That's number one. Number two, their target in all this is Howard. We've spent 5+ seasons with Howard. You know, we thought of him one way at the beginning, and then we were shown, you know, what kind of person he really is.
Yeah.
Howard, for whatever issues anyone might have, at the end of the day, Howard is not a bad guy. Even when he's trying to advise her, he's not mansplaining Jimmy to her. He's actually looking out to her because he has information that she doesn't have. You know, when he refers to Jimmy as a psychopath because he was throwing bowling balls at his car because he offered him a job.
Yes.
You know what? That's a le- c- kind of, you know what, that's kind of a legit warning.
Yeah, he wasn't out of line. You know? He wasn't out of line.
And it was, and especially when the reveal, when you realize it, like, it was Chuck really putting Howard in the position that he was in throughout those years at HHM. And he was the one that was really keeping Jimmy down more so than Howard ever was. Again, at the end of the day, he's not a bad guy. You know, he may be really too buttoned up, but that's just a personality thing. And the fact that Kim is going full bore against him, it's kind of like, it's almost like the transfer of Jimmy's reaction has now become Kim's reaction to Howard. And it's, so again, I'm not saying I'm not entertained by it. I'm not saying I'm fascinated by it, but it's all, but while it's a very mild extreme compared to things that we dealt with in the Breaking Bad universe, so to speak, it's still that kind of a thing where, you know, the things that Walt did, for example, were much bigger. They're much more life and death and whatever. You know, whether it be letting someone die or doing something to force someone to murder somebody, or, you know, sort of kind of almost kill a kid kind of a thing. Sort of kind of. But it's interesting that, okay, they're kind of doing a very lighter version of it here, but they're testing it just a little bit, because we've, especially with Kim as a character that we've loved from day one, and now, okay, they're just pushing us just a little bit. It's just lightly, it's like, okay, wait a minute. It goes to my comparison of the two shows, and people keep talking about how, you know, whether they like, you know, Better Call Saul better than Breaking Bad. And I had mentioned on our final Breaking Bad podcast, you can't make a decision about that till the show is over. And I don't think you have to wait. We have to see how this all plays out. The point that I would make, where Better Call Saul kind of works at an advantage is, where Breaking Bad tests you more than Better Call Saul did. If anything, maybe Better Call Saul at most, especially early on, you might say tested your patience a little bit. Not me personally, but maybe a little bit. Cause it was a very, Better Call Saul has definitely been much more of a slow burn than Breaking Bad ever was. But the point really being, but Breaking Bad tested you. And the fact is, once you got, every single viewer at some point, as I've mentioned too many times at this point, got off the Walter White train, and it put you in a position where you're not rooting or caring for the main character anymore. And now it becomes, you start caring about side characters, and even them you can find troubling at certain points, and the intensity just keeps building up. Better Call Saul is not doing that. Where we know we're going to, we went into this knowing, okay, we're going to watch the how this person becomes Saul Goodman. We already like Saul Goodman. We know he's kind of a sleazy, you know, scumbag lawyer, blah blah blah. But we kind of like him. We might not want him for our lawyer, or maybe we would, but we find him entertaining and enjoyable, whatever. Oh, and now we see what he used to be. And then the trick is then became, oh no, I don't want Jimmy to become Saul, because we really like Jimmy, because there's just more of a moral fiber to him. He's more of a stand-up guy than we've seen Saul Goodman ever be. And so, but the tragedy is not going to be anywhere near as extreme as what we experienced with Walter White, but you still have spent 5+ seasons watching and rooting for a character, and thus, so therefore you almost embrace it more than Breaking Bad, which kind of puts you, you know, it challenges you more, is what I'm saying with what Breaking Bad did. I love this show. I think it's on a par with it, but I don't think it's come to the point where it's surpassed it yet. I think there's a lot of great things about this show. I think it operated at both an advantage and a disadvantage. Because the big disadvantage, as we all know, is, well, we all know what's going to happen to all these main characters that we're starting to follow with Mike and Saul, whatever. How are you going to keep me interested? Hey, you know what? You did a damn fine job of it so far. And then you brought in these other characters that we, ostensibly, we know they're either going to die or disappear somewhere, but we still worried about them season after season after season. Now we've seen what happened to Nacho, which was a gut punch. We knew it was coming, and it still got us, but it went out in a great way. But now we're worried about Kim, and the fact that they keep pushing her, she's breaking more bad than anybody else right now, kind of makes you therefore worry more about what could happen with her. And again, it doesn't necessarily mean death, but some things might be worse than death. I don't know. There's a million possibilities. But that's why I wanted to open this episode, just me talking about that tequila topper again, because it's like, ooh, that's kind of an omen that I never really explored when we were talking last week.
Well, I have a couple things with Kim. Just a question for one. Do you think that, like, some of what's happening is her way of trying to the attack on Howard? Do you think some of it is a way to manage the guilt of what happened with Chuck? And I'm just going to go out and say, like, if I were her friend, if Kim was a real person and I was really her friend, I would say the words, he was mentally ill and his decisions led him to his demise. This isn't this. Yes, you can nudge and you can push, but at the end of the day, his illness and his refusal to seek help for it put him beyond the place where anyone else could help him. His loved ones could help him or something along those lines. So do you think some of the attack on Howard is a way for her to manage or rationalize or to numb the guilt that she has for what happened with Chuck? Or do you think that it's trying to one-up Jimmy? Like, because for some reason, everyone else talks down to Jimmy. Everyone else treats him like he's scum. But for some reason, there is something about him that she's kind of always looked up to. Something that she admires about some of his devious behavior and his way to make things work in his favor without following every single golden rule. So do you think she's trying to one-up him, or do you feel like this is her way of trying to rationalize or numb what's happened in the past with her involvement?
I don't see it that way. I think Jimmy, I think she had a plan for her life, and that plan, like, I think she had it planned out to a degree that there was no joy in her life. And Jimmy showed her some joy and unlocked the part of her that doesn't stay close with her family. That whatever she does, she's driven and, dare I say, compulsive, like mm-hmm. smoking. And I think that in Jimmy, there's another possibility of life that's fun and exciting, where she can do the things that she's good at and not have to follow every rule and not, you know, not be a country club person and not be Howard. And I think that how she doesn't hate Howard. Howard's the proxy for the life she hates. And the thing he stands for, the path in the law that she was on, but really wasn't rewarded by.
Well, when we kind of get that flashback of her with her mom in Nebraska, you know, like in the mall area that we joked about, like, is this the same mall in Nebraska? That whole scene we got with her as a kid. We talked about some of the comparisons that we could make in that very brief moment of meeting her mom to Jimmy. So do you think that maybe it was always like this fear underneath that she was going to be just like her mom, and so she went the completely opposite direction and followed everything by the book and played everything by the rules, but she was always still, her instinct is to be more like her mother or more like Jimmy than what society tells her is respectable?
I think her mom sucked at it, and she's really good at it.
Right.
And Jimmy's really good at it. And in him, she found her mom was not supportive and wasn't loving.
No.
Jimmy is, and which yes. is why we like him, even though they're toiling in the dark. Like, there is something supportive and loving about him. That,
absolutely. That's what Kim's always seen in him versus yes. someone like Chuck.
And so I think that what her mom sucked at and wasn't supportive of, that part of her personality, Jimmy really brought out and gave her permission to follow. and like she's just taken to it and really good at it.
All right.
Yeah, I would go along with that. Absolutely. Let's get to the valet scam then, which is probably the light, fun part of what's an otherwise heavy episode. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I love capers and heists and cons and scams and so on. You know, throw some time travel in there and you got me. This one, I felt, although it was one of the more mild scams, it did not disappoint. But it's to the point where it's not really worth, the actual scam itself is not really worth talking about. What I think is worth talking about, in my opinion, is that scene between Jimmy and Huel in the car.
Yes.
I'm going to say right now, other than all the, what was it? Mexico, all I'm saying? I can't remember. This might be Huel's finest moment on the on either series. The little bit.
The frings of the world have the Thurman Trouts. They have the Mikes, and the Sulls of the world have the Hewels.
I mean the whole thing. You know, you're a legit lawyer. Your wife's a legit lawyer. Why you do this? You know, it's, and one can say. In fact, someone said it to me earlier today, and I said I don't know if I agree with that take, but it's not a bad take. It's an interesting take. But it goes to what I was saying earlier, which was also echoing other people's sentiments, even though I was respectfully disagreeing at the time, was the writers might be a little bit aware of this might be the perspective of the viewer right now.
Yes.
Why are you doing this? What's going on? Why are you taking my time with this? You know, maybe not that extreme, but it is. It is kind of, it feels like a writer's room is like, okay, we need to kind of address this because now we're now going to be three episodes deep in this, and we're continuing to go down this path, and where is this going to go? Like I said, you're with a scheme that we already, it's not like a scheme where, okay, you have to do this. Like what happened, like what initially was going on with Chuck, whatever, although we saw where that unfortunately led. This is something they're doing more. You know, there's a more of a mischief and a spite element to it, whatever, which is making us kind of like, oh, Kim's moral center, which she's always had, she's been the compass, is shifting a little bit. It's like someone's moving a magnet around her a little bit here. And it's not him, because he's, you know, again, like you were saying earlier, he's still recovering from his post-traumatic stress, etc. And he's the one who's questioning this all the time. You know, are you sure? Is this what you really want? He might as well be saying, are you serious? But the Huel scene, I just loved it. It brought more of a smile to my face than anything else with the whole little, Keymaster scam. Although I do like using the word Keymaster. I was very happy to say, you know, our episode description will feature the word Keymaster. Spoiler.
I think in a weird way, Huel has been sort of an everyman voice of the audience all along in both shows. I mean, the you know, comment of like, you know, Mexico, I'm just saying, I mean, that's what you and I would say if we came across the big thing of money. Now, we probably also would say this is probably a bad idea and not do it. But I think Huel many times voices, you know, what the audience is thinking, and he's a great foil for that. And in this particular thing says, like, you know, basically he's telling Jimmy, like, I respect you. Like, you have real game. Why are you playing this silly game? And it's a very good use of a small character to make a big point. And Huel has done that several times in the show, and I thought it was excellent use of him here. And we're also reminded that apparently he is the greatest pickpocket in the world. So
absolutely. I don't know if there's really much else I'd like to, I kind of feel like that's pretty much where we can start to wrap up the podcast here, because we did go over where I wanted to go. But I feel like we've covered everything pretty much. I just came across the notes I actually had written about the whole Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul thing. And I was like, oh, I forgot I actually put notes. I could have been reading, checking, and going through my notes when I did all that. I covered almost everything. I left out the words, oppressively dark. Anyway. And Jamie has disappeared from our Skype connection, so hopefully she'll pop back on, at least to be able to say goodbye to you, but there'll be one less person to interrupt me while I try to wrap up here. Unless, Brian, do you have anything you want to come out with here?
No, I think we've covered it.
Thank you. So, if you enjoy this podcast, and why wouldn't you? You will enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. You can like the page and join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul or Go Back in Time for Breaking Bad or anything else that, you know, under the TV sun. You can find us pretty much where podcasts are found, you know, Spotify, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts. But better yet, you can just go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com where you can find all 340 episodes of our podcast. And don't worry, if you do a deep dive in the archive, you'll see things that say forbidden. That's bullshit. Just click on it. It'll work. You can find us on Instagram. Our handle there is Serious TV Drama, all is one word. And you can also, of course, find us on Twitter. I'm not really sure if Musk is buying it or not at this point. So, you know, we can still do a GoFundMe for that. Our handle there is, at STVD Podcast, STVD as in Serious TV Drama. We will be back next week to talk about, I believe the next episode's title is Hit and Run. So they're still continuing the blank and blank kind of, format. I'm curious if when they'll break that, because I suspect they will, just like Alpine Shepherd Boy broke the streak in season one of all the things that end with the O sound. So I'm sure they'll cheat again, with this. She hasn't come back yet. Oh, I'm very sad about that. All right. So anyway, I want to thank everybody out there for listening and thank Brian, Daniel, and the now absent Jamie, for joining us. If someone wants to say goodbye I know who will. Let's all make our goodbyes now. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. And Jamie agrees with me.
Oh, you betcha. I agree with you there, Brian. I just had to go make myself some pancakes tonight, eh?
I'm so glad she came back. Thanks, Jamie.
Oh, yeah. Yes, very good, Jamie. Okay, good night, guys.
Good night. Wait. Before we go, I forgot to mention, we're not going to use our usual outro music this week. We are actually going to fold in a little piece of music that Brian composed on his guitar earlier today as kind of a salute to our fallen, not comrade, because he wasn't our buddy, but, you know, one of our favorite characters, Nacho, tonight. I believe you refer to it as a Nacho Dirge.
Yep, Nacho's Dirge.
So, oh, and of course, right when I say that, my computer, just like last week, just went blank on me. Amazing. Mm. So you hear me typing, and look, the real life Jamie just came back.
I came back much like Mondo has experienced. We had a lightning strike nearby, and my Wi-Fi went kaput.
You betcha. Anyway, you had to be there. Anyway, so again, thank you everybody for listening and for indulging this extra minute just so I could tell you what to listen to. As great as our usual outro music is, we got a little special something for you this week. So here it is.